From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
We delve into the reasons behind changes to degree programs at Florida universities.
What is the value of this program to my university? What is it in financial terms? What is it in terms of workforce needs or student demand?
Also this week, the push to regulate big AI data centers in Florida gains traction in the state Senate.
This conversation will continue to evolve, and the power generators, the water suppliers, and the AI folks and the local communities are going to find a way to make all of this work.
We'll also hear from a state lawmaker who's determined to make Florida housing more plentiful and affordable, and we'll grab our tongs and head for the newly reopened oyster patches in Apalachicola Bay. I'm Tom Flanagan. Online and on air, this is Capitol Report and our weekly wrap-up of top stories from the 2026 lawmaking session in Tallahassee.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by the Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 1 million union members, retirees, and their families. Committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org.
Florida A&M University recently announced changes to some of its degree programs, mainly through consolidation. African American Studies is among those being impacted. State lawmakers have moved to end university-sponsored programs that relate to diversity, equity, and inclusion. And there are concerns that this is now impacting degree programs. Gina Jordan spoke with Ben Unglesby of the media outlet Higher Ed Dive, which goes in depth into higher education trends. His reporting finds that this kind of review of degree programs in Florida is much like what's happening in other parts of the country.
We've seen other states take up similar measures for their public universities. So Ohio and Indiana have both recently passed laws that require their state universities to review their programs for certain graduate thresholds. So graduate a certain number of students within a certain number of years. And if you don't meet a minimum threshold, they look at potentially cutting those programs. And other states, I think, are adopting or at least considering similar measures.
Okay, so that is definitely happening in Florida. Now, if we're talking specifically about FAMU, this is an HBCU that's making changes to its African American Studies program, among other programs. Does your investigation suggest that any of the changes that you've seen at any university could be related to state-level efforts to get rid of DEI-related programs?
Well, it's interesting. So some of the bills that look at minimum graduation thresholds, those reviews are independent of, but they were in bills that also looked at DEI. And I think, you know, a lot of the programs that have sort of low graduate numbers are often, you know, in area studies or other kinds of like liberal arts that might include coursework, looking at race or, you know, looking at gender, like women's studies. So those, just in terms of numbers, can be the kinds of programs that fall below those thresholds. Elsewhere, we're seeing those programs get targeted, you know, in a more direct sort of political manner.
Gotcha. So state education leaders say that changes have been recommended, but it's up to the universities. And like you say, these are based on thresholds. If Florida universities are looking at thresholds, what does that mean? Like, they talk about low productivity degree programs. Can you explain that?
Yeah, it can mean a lot of different things in a lot of different places. A lot of them, they're looking at how many students have graduated from the program per year within a set amount of years, say 3 years or 5 years. And if you have a minimum threshold, or if you're below sort of the minimum number of graduates per year within that time frame, it could get flagged for cutting. More broadly, you know, we're looking at colleges across the country, private and public, are kind of evaluating their programs based on, like, you can call it productivity, you can call it efficiency. And there's a lot of different ways of doing that, but you're basically trying to answer the question of like, what is the value of this program to my university? What is it in financial terms? What is it in terms of workforce needs or student demand? These are very difficult questions to answer, and they're not necessarily straightforward. Just trying to figure out what a program costs to operate, or how much revenue it brings in, that requires like a lot of data collection. And I know like this is sort of beyond the scope of the question, but if you're just looking at graduates, you can end up cutting programs that actually, even if they have low graduate levels or low enrollment levels, you can end up cutting programs that actually contribute financially to your school, even though they are relatively small. So if all you're doing is looking at one metric, that can be really problematic. That can be a case where you're cutting off your nose to spite your face. If you don't look at a sort of wide swath of data and do a really deep analysis, and also think about like, what does the program contribute to your school, to your state, to your student body? There's a lot of questions. And if you only ask, you know, one question about one metric, your answer might not give you the full picture.
Well, that's an interesting observation. So like, might you be talking about, say, there's a degree program that is below that threshold, but there are certain classes as part of that degree program that are very popular that students take, you know, regardless of their major.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a big question. And that's one of the ways that a program can still contribute, or potentially, you know, maybe it's an interdisciplinary program where your graduates are taking courses in a lot of other programs. So the program that they're majoring in might not cost you much money, but if you cut the program, then you lose those students because you don't have the program. They go to another school. Those are some of the reasons why schools would start that program to begin with. Like, hey, this isn't going to necessarily cost us anything, and we can attract maybe a few extra students that might have gone somewhere else because we didn't have this program for them. But then again, there are programs that maybe have lost their relevance with students, and those need to be sort of thought through. I mean, there's a lot of questions to ask. And if you're just asking one question and your solution is to cut that program based on the answer to one question or one metric, that's a pretty blunt instrument to use in your evaluation of a college's programs. A lot matters in not only like what the thresholds are, what the metrics are, but the process matters a lot. And it matters a lot to all the stakeholders on campus.
Yeah. Is there anything that you want to add based on your reporting about changes to degree programs?
It's happening in a lot of places, not just at public universities. You know, a lot of colleges are under budget pressure, and so they're looking at their programs. But it's a very complicated question to ask, what is the financial cost and benefit of a program? And the answers are not straightforward. And you can make decisions that have different ramifications than what you expected. So it's a process to undertake with a lot of thought and care and precision and consultation with all your stakeholders, I think.
All right, Ben Unglesby with the media outlet Higher Ed Dive. Thanks for your time and your reporting.
Thank you so much for having me.
New restrictions on large-scale data centers, part of Governor Ron DeSantis's push to deal with the maturing field of artificial intelligence, won Senate backing this week. After a unanimous vote, the bill now heads to the House. The measure addresses key issues such as electricity and water use needed to maintain the data centers and generally requires public notice of when plans are filed for a data center in the region. Senate President Ben Albritton says the proposal intends to help Floridians avoid issues already experienced in other states like Virginia, where ratepayers have seen price increases with the arrival of the massive energy-demanding data centers.
This conversation will continue to evolve, and the power generators, the water suppliers, and the AI folks and the local communities are going to find a way to make all of this work.
The data center bill, in part, would require the Florida Public Service Commission to develop what are known as tariffs and service requirements to ensure that each large load customer bears its own full cost of service and that such cost is not shifted to the general body of ratepayers. Also in Tallahassee this week, emergency management officials finally showed off their new $180 million Emergency Operations Center, more than doubling the space for workers who have worked nonstop in some capacity under a declared state of emergency for more than 4 years. The new building in Tallahassee is across the street from the current complex, which is 30 years old and only built to withstand a Category 3 hurricane. The new complex is promoted as able to withstand winds up to 200 miles per hour and provide significantly more space in the main operating room. Kevin Guthrie, the executive director of the Division of Emergency Management.
When disaster strikes, this building will help us move faster, coordinate smarter, and recover stronger. The center stands as a symbol of Florida's proactive approach to emergency management and our unwavering commitment to protecting our residents.
The facility also features a redundant power system that includes 3 backup generators, 2 truck loading docks, and a 95 by 13 foot video wall. Housing issues have been a critical concern in the Florida legislature for the past several years, and this year is no different. Miami Republican Senator Alexis Calatayud is one of the youngest lawmakers in the chamber and is carrying a host of housing bills. WFSU's Tristan Wood spoke with her about her bills and what housing challenges Floridians face.
In years past, you carried the Live Local Act, and you've really been one of the lawmakers that I feel has been carrying a lot of legislation focused around making housing more affordable in Florida. What challenges still exist for affordable housing in the state, and how is that manifesting in your district?
One of the challenges that we have in continued efforts to expand the amount of attainable housing in the state of Florida and in my district is making sure that we are partners with local government and that we have the smoothest possible permitting and zoning processes to make sure that what is possible with financing, with zoning, with the willingness of private and market rate developers to make workforce and affordable housing, that we remove those barriers.
Talking about some of your bills that are moving so far, House Bill 1434, the Infill Redevelopment Act. Talk to me a little bit about that. Why is that necessary this year, and how does it address some of those? How does it help with housing?
Absolutely. So all of this policy is focused on increasing the amount of housing stock or making it easier for first-time home buyers to buy a house. So it's one of those two. This particular policy is focused on contaminated land that right now has no utility. Brownfields or phase two contaminations. And what this policy does is create an expedited zoning and permitting process that maintains all of the environmental protections, but it hyperspeeds the process of land entitlement so that we can strategically and in a focused manner increase the amount of housing stock. So the process of that bill is to increase the amount of this style of housing stock in areas that would otherwise be underdeveloped and are currently contaminated. And to go from the process of contamination to cleaned to zoned and permitted for housing stock, we want to make that faster to make that investment in reduction, the elimination of contamination, all make sense.
Another bill that caught my attention, House Bill 1432, would allow a one-time payout of sick leave and vacation time for public employees in the state for down payments on a home. I know my coverage area is Tallahassee and the Panhandle in general. A lot of state employees live there. Why this bill? Why is this a policy that you filed? And why is it something that you think would help housing in Florida?
This is a policy that came from a friend of mine who's a former legislative aide with me when I was at the House of Representatives. And he said, Alexis, I know you work on Live Local. I know you work on other housing policy. Just trying to find good ideas. He brought this concept to me and said, what if people like us, who were aides or staffers or in any level of state government, what if they were able to use that accrued benefit in a different way? And so I viewed this as being really useful to stack on the Hometown Heroes program that we created years ago, I think 4 or 5 years ago now, which provides a 0% interest, $35,000 down payment assistance grant that you only have to pay off if you sell the home or at the end of your mortgage. So if you could access that down payment assistance, have your savings, and then also leverage your own accrued benefits, it really just gets you faster into the home that you wish to buy. And so as I mentioned before, it's about increasing housing stock for the rental market, and it's making it faster to purchase a home.
Why is increasing the speed that people can get in home, why is that an important policy that the state of Florida should be concerned about?
It's separate from the sheer finances of it, right? Every month you're paying rent is a month you're not paying mortgage into the equity that you and your family keep forever, God willing. It's also because I think home ownership is a core tenet of what we feel as a nation is a part of the American dream. In a time where single family homes are becoming harder to purchase, the lifestyle in urban communities is becoming one that, am I only ever going to live in a condo? Or, you know, what is the lifestyle of the middle class? What should the American expectation, the American dream, become in 2026 for millennials or Gen Z? Should it be different than Gen X and boomers? These are real questions. And I think a prioritization of the state of Florida on what has defined the American experience and the American middle class is really important. People need to have continued hope that hard work ultimately pays off in these really profound and fulfilling ways. And as a younger lawmaker, I also think young Americans need to have continued confidence that they're doing all the right things, and they will see the fruits of those labors. And this is just a small way that we can empower and champion, I think, younger Floridians.
Yeah, on that.
First-time homebuyers,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, on that a little bit. You talked about your district a little bit,
yeah.
But, I mean, also if you've looked at, like, statewide data, Florida's population's grown, but in that, like, 20 to 29 demographic of Floridians that, you know, live here, you know, that's the largest population of people leaving the state. In fact, I think it's one of the only age demographics where more people are leaving than coming in. How does this policy that you're championing help try to turn that trend around and keep more young people staying in Florida as opposed to moving to other places?
When I knocked on doors to get elected in 2022, I met a lot of men and women in their 60s saying, there's no place for my kid to live in my community. And they're all leaving. All my kids are leaving. And I remember sitting at the doorstep talking to them, realizing I was the same age as their kid, who does not think they have a place in Miami. Maybe reasonably so with the pricing and the cost of living. I think that core tenet at the heart of what's driving Live Local and what's driving our affordability policy is what's going to make a difference. Those 15,000 units that are 10% below market rate, the exponential increase of units, not just in South Florida, but across the state, that are being powered by Live Local's land use entitlements, is going to make a big difference in decreasing the cost by competition of increased housing stock. And then the last piece is those lower rents mean that you can keep more money in your pocket for the down payment that you need to get into a condo, to buy your first home, condo, whatever that is, home ownership. And then the down payment assistance program that we're continually funding. So I think this is exactly what we should be doing. What's cool is Republican, Democrat, around the country, these reforms are what's being championed by people who are serious about increasing housing affordability and increasing housing stock to that same end.
That's South Florida Republican State Senator Alexis Calatayud speaking with Tristan Wood. Florida lawmakers have given attention this session to electric motorized devices, especially amid the surge in e-bike popularity and accidents. WUSF's Megan Bowman reports on the new proposals.
Is it a bird? A plane? Nope. That's an electric bike. And if you stand long enough in one spot on the University of South Florida's Tampa campus, you'll either see lots of e-bike riders or nearly get run over by one. For some people, it's another way to get from point A to point B. But for Brighton Glass, who turns 20 in March and works on campus, e-biking is a hobby.
How fast can it go?
In Eco, it'll go up to 28 miles an hour, and in Sport Mode, it'll hit up to 52 miles an hour.
His black 2024 Saron Light BX is considered a high-performance electric dirt bike. Retailing at around $4,500, the Light B doesn't have typical pedals, just two spots to rest your feet. The Saron takes about 2 hours to fully charge and can run about 80 miles on a full battery. But Glass says it's a very dangerous hobby.
No matter what anyone says, no matter how good you try to dress for sliding, if you drop your bike, no matter what you do, if you're on two wheels, you don't have four doors covering you.
It's why Glass says wearing a helmet is so important.
I've crashed this bike multiple times. A helmet has saved me before. I've had friends that have crashed. Helmets have saved them.
Current state law requires anyone under 16 to wear a helmet. But Freedom High School senior Maggie Takamatsu is trying to change that. After one of her schoolmates died in an e-bike accident, she says she wanted to learn more about the rules.
I was talking to a pathophysiologist and my friend who was in med school, and they'd both seen so many incidents of e-bikes and e-scooter accidents that it made me wonder, like, what are the laws? What are we doing to protect these kids? And he didn't have an answer for me, so he proposed that I take it to Ought to Be a Law.
Ought to Be a Law is a program in Hillsborough County Schools. It allows students to work with state lawmakers to draft, lobby, and present a real proposal during the legislative session. Takamatsu, along with a few other students, presented a bill to raise Florida's minimum age to wear a helmet from 16 to 18. Now her bill is working its way through the state house.
Our bill isn't here to restrict people, but to protect them.
Even hospitals are getting involved. Dr. Jennifer Caputo-Seidler works in the trauma program at Tampa General.
I would encourage anybody who's getting on an e-bike or an e-scooter to wear a helmet.
She says compared to last year, the trauma department has seen a large increase in e-bike and e-scooter accidents.
Head injuries are definitely the most common injury we're seeing, and most of it is because of low helmet usage. You have to protect your brain. You can't replace it.
Caputo Seidler says if you ride without a helmet and crash, there could be dire consequences.
You could have permanent damage from a head injury given the speeds at which these vehicles can travel.
And that top speed is partly why other bills to regulate e-bikes are moving through the legislature. Similar bipartisan proposals in the House and Senate would create a task force to investigate e-bike safety. It would also require e-riders to slow down, yield to pedestrians, and signal to pass. Supporters say the new rules would make the roads safer for everyone. But some local governments are moving forward with their own e-bike ordinances instead of waiting for the state. Key Biscayne has maintained a full ban after a fatal accident in 2024 when a 12-year-old e-bike rider struck and killed a bicyclist. Charlotte County commissioners passed new requirements in February, including imposing a 15-mile-an-hour speed limit for most electric motorized devices. Rita Miotti is president of Friends of the Legacy Trail. She says there's been a lot of complaints along the popular 18-mile paved multi-use trail from Sarasota to Venice. But it's not just young riders popping wheelies.
Unfortunately, we also have grown individuals riding these bikes that are causing problems with their speed.
Standing beside her own gold Magnum e-bike next to the trail, Miotti says she wants to see some new regulations, but not too many.
It needs to be looked at, but it needs to be reasonable, and we need to have method for the law enforcement to enforce these things.
Sarasota Sheriff Deputy Jimmy Adams says his department is focusing on education rather than enforcement, hoping to save lives.
We are getting, unfortunately, a rise in injuries with these as well. And I think even sometimes there have been some deaths involved with these devices, which is why this has become such a focal point.
The electric bike proposals have more committee stops before they'll go to a full vote. I'm Megan Bowman in Tampa.
You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, Apalachicola Bay was once a major source of oysters in the United States, but a combination of droughts, disasters, and over-harvesting led to the collapse of the fishery and eventually a decision to close the bay to wild oyster harvesting for 5 years. That moratorium was lifted for a short harvest in January and February. Regan McCarthy takes us to the bay, where we hear directly from oyster harvesters and oyster eaters.
Roger Mathis has been working on the water since he was 6 years old. Now, at 68, it's still the way he prefers to make his living. But for almost a decade, he says he hasn't been able to.
2017, the last time I come out in 17, the horse was just gone. So I just quit. I come over here and started cleaning houses for my wife.
He not only helped his wife clean houses, he also worked as a handyman and took jobs with researchers who studied the bay to make ends meet. Now, some of the oyster populations are beginning to recover, so much so that through the end of this month, the bay is open to wild harvest again. That means Mathis is back out on the water, and this time he says there are a lot more oysters.
But it's so thick down there right now, you see, it don't take just a second to get it. Just takes longer to cull it than it does anything.
He's using oyster tongs, think 12-foot-long poles with garden rakes attached at the end, to scoop the oysters up from the reef.
But that, my friend, is oystering.
After dumping a load of oysters onto the boat, Mathis gets to work culling. He's sorting through the oysters, whacking them with a long metal tool to separate the shells from the rocks. Those rocks were dumped here by researchers for baby oysters to attach to. And in this part of the bay, it worked. They grew a lot.
This is the biggest oysters, most oysters I've seen out here in a long, long time.
They are big. They've been in that water growing for so long.
Kayla Griffin is a server at the Red Pirate Oyster Bar in the small town of East Point. She says oystering is an important part of her community's culture.
And it's nice being able to have our oystermen back on the bay and our oystermen being able to be seen going over the bridges. That's good for our hearts.
She says this two-month window for wild oysters has been good for business, too.
People are calling all day, are y'all serving the wild caught oysters?
Wildlife officials are closely watching the temporary harvest as much of the bay is still in recovery mode. Sandra Brooke is a researcher at the Florida State University Coastal and Marine Lab. She says it will take careful management for the oyster populations to survive and thrive.
From a scientific ecological perspective, my personal preference would have been that they left it closed for another 5 or so years to let the populations become a little bit less vulnerable.
But Brooke recognizes temporarily opening parts of the bay is important to protect the future of the fishery and the culture here.
People got out of the fishery. I mean, you see people that have been in it for generations, but most of them, their kids are not going to be oyster fishermen.
For Mathis, that's true. While he and his son have been out tonging during the recent opening, that's not how his son makes his living. Mathis says it all reminds him of an old song an old friend wrote.
You ever heard that song, Oyster Man Blues? A friend of mine named Mac Novak wrote it back when we was 18 years old. Well, his day starts at 5 a.m. He hits the bar, got his Maxwell House coffee in a Bama mayonnaise jar.
Out goes the anchor, and then over goes the tongs. At 10 a.m., they're saying, oh, Lord, where did
I'm Regan McCarthy in Apalachicola, Florida.
The bay is set to open for wild harvest again in October for a season that's expected to run through February of next year. Our regular Capital Report correspondents are Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Megan Bowman. Technical support for Capital Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. We hope you'll join us again next week online and on air for more reports from the state capitol.
Support for Capital Report is provided by the Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 1 million union members, retirees, and their families. Committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org. Capital Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.